From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Catherine Price says our national obsession with vitamins tells us something about ourselves. It tells us we fear getting old and dying. It tells us we want to be in control. Our trust in vitamins, our reverence for them, is more than just an appreciation. She says it's something that resembles a religious faith. And like in some cases of faith, rational thought can fall by the wayside. Price says we've come to passively accept health claims about vitamins and supplements without asking if the science backs it up. Because science is still figuring vitamins out. We don't have a complete grasp on how they work in our bodies. Today in the program, Catherine Price will join us to talk about her book. It's called Vitamania. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we know a lot more about vitamins than in the days when men were dying of scurvy on the high seas, but Catherine Price says there are still plenty of holes in our understanding of vitamins in particular and nutrition in general. Researchers and scientists are figuring it out. At least we're coming to an understanding of the things we know and the things we don't. We still don't know, for example, how vitamins actually work in our bodies or really just how much we need. Price says our faith in vitamins has made us look the other way in some cases. We don't notice the ways food marketers and supplement makers can twist the language about vitamins and health. We don't acknowledge how we sometimes use vitamins to give ourselves a free pass to overeat other foods. In that sense, Price says there's this irony in this faith that by believing that isolated dietary chemicals hold the keys to good health, our vitamania, as she puts it, could actually be making us less healthy. Vitamania is the name of her book, and today in the program, Catherine Price is joining us to talk about it. Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection, is the whole title. Catherine Price has written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, Salon, Outside Magazine. She's joining us today from the studios of WRTI on the campus of Temple University in Philadelphia. And Catherine Price, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, I wanted to start with that that idea of the sense of faith that we have, which you say that our hope and our trust in vitamins sometimes can kind of resemble religious faith. So just broadly, let's start there. Explain what you mean. What is it that how does it compare our trust in vitamins and the sense of faith?
Well, I appreciate your diving right into the philosophy from the very beginning. I think that what I found really interesting while I was researching this book was, first of all, as you just hinted out in the intro, how much is still unknown, both about vitamins and nutrition. And then I started thinking, if there's so much that's unknown, why do we feed our kids Flintstones, and why do we eat Total cereal, and why are we just so attracted to these things?
Yeah.
What I came up with is something that I think applies both to vitamins and also to our obsession with finding isolated dietary chemicals in general that make us healthy, which is that, you know, our health is something we desperately want to have control over, but ultimately we only have so much control, and there's so much uncertainty, and there's only so much we can do in a lot of cases. And so we want to have some way of making ourselves feel better about that, something we can do proactively and put our faith in. And I think that vitamins, and in a broader sense, a lot of the claims that we hear for particular dietary chemicals, I really fill that void. And we are able to believe that if we just get enough vitamins, then we're protecting ourselves against this frightening unknown.
Were you at all surprised at how political this whole story could be? I mean, we're going to get to the FDA and regulation and stuff like that a little bit later in the program. I want to get some groundwork laid first, but what are you noticing from the reaction so far? I know that you're getting certain rebuttals, but a lot of people pay a lot of attention to this stuff.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I am not someone who gravitates towards writing about politics. I'm actually very non-confrontational. And when I started researching this project, my goal was just to answer questions about vitamins.
Yeah.
I should clarify right off from the beginning that when I say vitamins, I'm talking about just the 13 dietary chemicals known as vitamins, which is A, C, D, E, K, and then the 8 B vitamins. And roughly speaking, they're, you know, dietary chemicals we need in small amounts to prevent a specific deficiency. And that's not the same thing as the much, much, much larger category of dietary supplements in the United States, which includes herbals, botanicals, fish oil, bodybuilding powders, like everything else you see on a drugstore or GNC shelves. So, yeah, it's been very interesting to see people's reactions to the subject of vitamins. And I did have to end up getting more political in the book than I originally intended, just because the story of regulation of vitamins and dietary supplements is so complicated and has so much, you know, there's so many parts that are very political in that story. So I kind of got dragged into that part.
Yeah. And you mentioned our senior senator, Orrin Hatch, and we'll talk about his role in all of this, because he's played a pretty big role, I have to say, at least in that part of the story.
Yes, and it feels weird to call someone out in particular, but he is, I believe that the quote that comes to mind is a natural ally of the supplement industry and has done an enormous amount to protect the industry for the state, which, I mean, obviously makes sense if you're the senator for the state, but it's interesting.
Yeah. So you mentioned one really important theme in the book. You know, scientists still don't have, you know, a complete grasp on how vitamins really work in our bodies, how much we need, you know, a kind of scientific uncertainty. I wanted to get this other point, which you make from time to time in the book, out of the way, because I think it's important, because you say that much of the developing world, in fact, isn't getting enough vitamins. But here's the thing that's weird about all of this is it seems like most vitamins and supplements are taken by people who, it could be argued in some ways, don't really need them because they can afford food, good food.
Yeah, it's very interesting when you get into the question of deficiencies. So when you're talking about reactions to the book so far, one thing that I do keep hearing or seeing is these headlines like, we don't need vitamins, they're making us sick, things like that. And I'm always like, oh, wait, no, that's not true at all.
Right.
Human beings need vitamins. Yeah. Please don't stop eating oranges or whatever. You know, that's not a good idea. But, you know, it is interesting to see this division between the developing world, where, I mean, most Americans never think about this. I certainly didn't, but vitamin deficiencies are a huge problem.
Yeah.
To a terrifying degree. You know, the WHO, the World Health Organization, estimates that between 250 and 500,000 kids around the world are going blind as a result of vitamin A deficiency each year. And, you know, up to 90% of those kids might die from it. So this is an enormous problem. And it's really crazy to think that it could be prevented if those kids got even twice yearly capsules of vitamin A just squirted into their mouths. Like that's just nuts. And then on the flip side, you have us in America, where we do have access to as many vitamin supplements as we want. And even if we don't want to buy those, many of our foods are fortified with synthetic, meaning man-made vitamins. So there is this abundance of vitamins available to us. And as you said, it is interesting also that in many cases, the people who are taking the most dietary supplements are probably the people who need them the least, because they tend to be following other healthy lifestyle patterns to begin with.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I don't want to lose the sight of the fact, though, either, that there are people in the United States who are deficient in micronutrients, and it can be a problem here. It just tends not to be among the people who are asking the questions about whether they should be taking a multivitamin.
Yeah. You know, among the things you set out to explore was this question. What facts about nutrition might our grandchildren be amazed to learn that we don't know? What interests you in that question? What we're on the brink of learning, or what we may learn, or just how little we know, I guess?
I think I was struck through the whole process by how much preemptive pride humans can feel about thinking they've figured out everything about nutrition.
Yeah.
So one thing that really interested me about the history of vitamins, which were actually only discovered at the turn of the 20th century,
right,
the word was coined in 1911, is that before that, we were patting ourselves on the back for having figured out calories and the macronutrients, so, you know, protein, carbohydrate, and fat. And we thought, oh, if you just have a diet that contains the right balance of these three macronutrients, you should be fine. And then scientists started making what was called what were known as purified diets, which was basically man-made reverse engineered food, and found that these lab animals started dying from these diets, and they couldn't figure out why. And eventually that is part of what led to the discovery of the vitamins. So I thought that was really interesting historically, because we look back at that now and we say, oh my God, like, how stupid could you be? You know, give those sailors some lemons and give that mouse some milk. Like, come on, right? But then I thought it was interesting to think this is all part of the same historical continuum, where there's probably lots of things about nutrition that we don't know about today that our grandkids will not be able to believe that we didn't know about. And the reason I bring that up is I think it's if you think you figured everything out, then you're tempted to trust man-made food in a way that I think is not really that smart, because while we have learned an enormous amount, there's still stuff we don't know. So it's really kind of hubristic to think that we can recreate nature.
I love the story that you tell. This is the late 1800s. This disease, this epidemic emerges called pellagra. And everyone thinks that it's a germ. But then there's this physician named Joseph Goldberger, and he gets involved in the case. And he studies, and he realizes he's not, I don't think he's entirely sure what it is, or at least he can't convince everyone of what it is. But what he's sure it isn't is a germ. And so he has these, what does he call them, filth parties?
Yes, filth parties, one of my favorite historical details ever.
Yeah. Would you tell about this story, because I think it's interesting.
Sure. So pellagra is a deficiency in niacin, and this was actually a huge problem in the American South in the 30s. I mean, up to the point when niacin was recognized as its cure, which I believe was 1937. The problem here began, as you just mentioned, with the emergence of germ theory of disease, which basically is the recognition that of infectious diseases, that diseases can be caused by microbes, these tiny creatures that we can't see. And that revelation began in the 1870s and obviously was enormously important for medicine and science. But it happened to be around the same time that these nutritional deficiency diseases started to become more of an issue. And the result was that a lot of times early scientists, when they were investigating things like pellagra or the other things we now know are vitamin deficiency diseases, we're searching for a microbe.
Yeah.
So Joseph Goldberger was kind of late in this process, actually after vitamins had been acknowledged as a thing and after nutritional deficiency diseases had also been acknowledged. But people did not want to accept the idea that pellagra might be a deficiency disease. And it's a horrible disease, by the way. It's the 4Ds, dermatitis, diarrhea, dementia, dermatitis, and death, which is four things you don't really want, particularly if it's curable by just having some niacin. And this was like, I mean, people were going crazy and then dying because of a deficiency in niacin. So Goldberger, who was from the North and Jewish, was sent to the South to investigate this. And he started hypothesizing that this was because of the Southern diet that was very heavy in corn and molasses and I think it was like fatty pork or something that didn't have much, no, that's not correct, but something that didn't have much niacin in it. But no one wanted to believe him. So the filth parties that you bring up were this series of gatherings, and that's his term for it, where he got together some of his medical colleagues and medical students, and he, this is so gross, he got secretions from people with pellagra, like mucus and blood.
And other stuff.
Yeah. And he either made it into the little pills that he and his colleagues ate, or he injected blood from people with pellagra into, you know, the volunteers. And his point was to prove that if it was an infectious disease, then they would get pellagra and potentially die. But he was so convinced that it was not that he was willing to, you know, put these things into his own body. And his wife even wanted to participate, but they wouldn't let her eat the stuff. So she instead convinced them to inject her with a bunch of blood from a person with pellagra. And the nurse who was attending, you know, started crying because she thought this was a suicidal act. But as it turned out, he was correct.
You know, it's so interesting. I mean, this is such a relatively new, our understanding is so relatively new. As you said, it really wasn't, we didn't really know what it was, have a name for it, I suppose, until the 20th century, the earliest part of the 20th century. But it wasn't long, you write in the book, before vitamins spread from, as you say, the labs of scientists to the offices of food marketers. And you say in the book that at that point, vitamins take on a life of their own in that sense. Explain that, if you would, that relationship that happens really early on between vitamins and people who are making food.
Sure. So, as I mentioned, the word itself was coined in 1911, and it was made up by this Polish biochemist named Casimir Funk, which is a great name. And it was before any vitamin had actually been isolated from food, but he was studying what we now know as the thiamine deficiency disease of beriberi, and he decided to come up with a name with this substance he thought was preventative for beriberi. So he combined the Latin word for life, which is vita, with amine, which was the chemical type of compound that he thought all of these vitamins would turn out to be, which they didn't. But he stuck these two words together, and he came up with vitamine. So it used to have an E on the end. And what's interesting about that is a lot of the early actual researchers didn't think that term would last because it wasn't actually scientific. It didn't actually describe the chemical structure of these things, and they didn't all have that much in common, actually. So they suggested other things like food hormone or accessory factor or water-soluble B, basically like really boring.
Really
potentially,
boring.
Yeah, really boring, but maybe, in some cases more accurate terms. But yeah, those are bad words. So what happened is basically, starting as early as the 1920s, some of the people, the scientists who were first involved in the study of vitamins also started writing for the popular press. So you have, for example, a guy named Elmer McCollum, mm-hmm. who was instrumental in vitamin A. He starts writing for McCall's magazine, a nutritional column. And he was like a nutritional guru of his day. And he wrote a bunch about vitamins. And so that kind of helped get the awareness to the public. And then food marketers, to get to your question, realized that vitamins were pretty amazing from a marketing perspective, because first of all, the word's great. But second, the scientists are proving and communicating to the public that there are these invisible, tasteless things in food that are necessary for health. And if you don't have enough of them, horrible things will happen to you. Granted, you have to be really deficient before horrible things start to happen. But they didn't need to dwell on that. So what they started to do was take advantage of the fact that no one could measure vitamins at that point. No one knew how much you needed. You can't taste them. You can't see them.
Yeah.
But if you can figure out that, say, your canned pineapple has vitamin C in it, then you can put together a pretty great ad campaign about how responsible housewives are going to feed
right.
their families meals that start and end with canned pineapple. You know, so it just opened up this whole world of pretty creative advertisements. And that continued.
Yeah. Well, this, you know, because you write about, we have this kind of psychological attachment to vitamins in that sense, which makes us vulnerable, as you say, to marketers, you know, people who may want to sort of push those points, stretch them a little bit, manipulate us. I mean, they're really powerful marketing tools, I guess, from the get-go. And I suppose they still are. Doesn't seem to me things have really changed in that way.
Yeah, I think that vitamins are very interesting in that they are miraculous if you actually are deficient in them, and we do actually need them. But it's not true that then if you need a certain amount of them to stay alive, then if you take or eat 16 times more, that you're going to become a superhero or something. But it's a very appealing idea. And it's also helped by the fact that in the short term, most vitamins are not going to hurt you if you eat too many, you know, too much of them. It's very hard to overdose on vitamins from foods that naturally contain vitamins, with the exception of vitamin A. Don't eat polar bear liver is my takeaway from that. It has like crazy amounts of vitamin A and it can kill you. But, you know, yeah, we do live in a world now where vitamins can be used to sell products that otherwise wouldn't really seem that healthy, and in fact are not that healthy, yeah. But the fact that they have vitamins make them seem like they must be.
We're going to get to the question of regulation when we get back from a break, but just generally, do you have any idea just how much fudging with the truth is going on in the American food industry? You know, just how much are we being fooled or just misled, just generally speaking? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, I think it depends on the person, and it depends on how you think about things, I guess. I mean, there are strict regulations on claims that can be made on food, much less stringent regulations on claims that can be made on supplements.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of stuff going on with the supplements, which we can get to later, but where it'll say things that a vitamin supports, for example, that strongly implies that it's going to do something proactive, but it doesn't actually say that. So you have that category of things. Then you have I think with foods, it actually is more, I was going to say baggage, but more this feeling that we carry along with us that vitamins are good, and that therefore, if you see that cocoa pebbles are a, quote, excellent source of vitamin D, that just makes you feel better about the Cocoa Puffs than you would otherwise if it didn't have that on it. But they haven't really said anything about what it'll do, but it just feels better. Mm.
Catherine Price is with us. Her book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about vitamins. It's become shorthand for healthy, and they can be, of course, but the journalist Catherine Price wanted to know how they work. So she's written a book that explores what vitamins do for our bodies, but also how much we need and in what form. She's talking about the vitamins in our food and the vitamins we get from pills and supplements. And this is a story that says a lot about us, she says, about our fears, our quest for nutritional perfection. Her book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. So I want to take a call from Anthony, who's calling from Salt Lake City. We could talk endlessly about all of the particulars, you know, K and all the Bs and all of that kind of stuff. But Anthony has a question about vitamin C, which may get us. I think that's such a common vitamin. And I think there are a lot of ideas about vitamin C that this may be a good way to sort of start with that one. Let's get Anthony on the line from Salt Lake. Anthony, hi.
Hi, Doug. My question, I guess, and it's sort of a comment as well. I stand to be corrected, certainly. But as far as I understand, vitamin C is absolutely an important a cofactor in making the protein collagen, which holds our skin and blood vessels together. But it seems like, and my members of my family are certainly guilty of this as well, that, you know, we have this sort of notion, or in some cases almost this cult following, of vitamin C is something that will somehow give us this amazing immune system and protect us against all sorts of things, from the common cold to the flu. And as far as I understand, that's really not based in any sort of scientific fact. Is that the case?
Yeah. What do you know, Catherine Pryor? What did you learn about vitamin C?
Yeah, vitamin C is an interesting one because, like you're saying, it has kind of attracted this cult following, in large part because of Linus Pauling, the Nobel Prize winning chemist who got very into vitamin C in the 60s and 70s. And yeah, so there's been a lot of research done on whether or not this commonly held belief that vitamin C can prevent colds is actually true, and that has not been proven true. I believe there was one study that suggested perhaps it could shorten the duration of a cold, but it was not definitive, and it does not back up the amount of airborne that is currently being consumed in the United States. But what I find particularly interesting about vitamin C, and what did not occur to me before I researched this book, is that we tend to think of C and the other water-soluble vitamins, in other words, the ones that can be dissolved in water and then passed out in our urine pretty easily, we tend to think about them as totally safe, so that it's like, maybe these people at NIH or whatever, they haven't proved that C works, but it doesn't really matter. I'm just going to take it because what harm can it do?
Yeah.
And, in the case of C, for example, in the short term, that's true. You're not going to have signs of acute C toxicity or anything if you do pop a bunch of those pills. But what I find fascinating is that there's a lot of people who are taking really big doses of C and the other water-soluble vitamins over long periods of time, under the assumption that at very worst, they're doing nothing, and hopefully they're doing something good. And I just don't really think that's that wise of an attitude for us to have. The reason being that to get to the point that you're actually peeing out vitamin C, you really have to saturate your body with vitamin C. It's a lot more than just the amount that you need to prevent scurvy. Yeah. And we don't really know what the effect of that is over long periods of time. It's very difficult to study that, and we just don't know. And there is emerging research that I find really interesting about antioxidants. Vitamin C is an antioxidant, meaning that a lot of people take it to protect against this kind of molecule called a free radical that can cause DNA damage and things. And we tend to think also antioxidants always good, but there's actually emerging research showing that free radicals themselves could have beneficial purposes in the body, and that you can have too many antioxidants. And that just makes me wonder, if C is an antioxidant, we're taking lots and lots and lots of C every day, could that be throwing something else out of balance that we just don't know about? Mm-hmm. And I don't have the answer to that question, because no one has the answer to that question yet. But I think it's important to keep in mind that just because we need a substance in a small amount, and just because taking a larger amount doesn't hurt us today, does not mean it's not doing something that could harm us in the future.
What about multivitamins? I mean, because there are questions about whether they're, in fact, actually helpful. But you say they probably aren't hurting you, but just how helpful? I mean, because there are also studies that show that there's this correlation between taking multivitamins and this increased risk of mortality in certain, you know, sections of the public. So what do we know about multivitamins?
Well, multivitamins are a great example of how we really want to have a one-size-fits-all answer.
Yeah.
And how you really can't have a one-size-fits-all answer when it comes to nutrition. Because a lot of times people will ask me, okay, well, should I take a multivitamin? And the answer I say is, I don't know. I can't tell you if you're going to you should take a multivitamin because I don't know what you're eating. And you need to think about what you're eating before you ask that question. And then I think it's possible for all of us to kind of make an intelligent decision about that. So the way I see it, you can kind of break down people into one of three broad categories. You've got on the one end of the spectrum, people who are actually following nutritionist advice and getting lots of nutrients from foods that naturally contain them and eating lots of carrots and kale and spinach and stuff like that. And they're probably doing just fine in terms of vitamins. And they're also getting lots of benefits from other stuff in the food that are not contained in the multivitamin pills. Then you have a large segment of the population that maybe, sure, they're having a salad now and then, but they're eating a lot of refined foods. But those foods have a lot of synthetic vitamins in them, so they're probably fine in terms of vitamins also, just because they're getting these man-made additions.
Right.
But then you also have this third category of people who are eating diets that are heavy in foods that are so nutritionally poor they actually haven't been fortified with additional vitamins or minerals or whatever, and they don't naturally contain them. And so you actually can have deficiencies. So in those cases, a multivitamin really would be helpful. I mean, I would argue that first you should change your diet rather than turning to a pill.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's not a black and white issue. I mean, there is no big health organization in the U.S. that recommends the routine use of multivitamins for otherwise healthy people. But then it comes down to the question of what's an otherwise healthy person and do you fall into that category? So, yeah.
Well, it's interesting.
I would say, you know, yeah, I don't think it's going to hurt you really, but it's not everyone needs them, but then there are some people who do. So the nuance.
Well, this idea of one size fits all, wanting one pill that will, you know, fix everything, that kind of brings up the question of recommended daily allowance, because you talk about how RDAs are not meant to be personal at all. I guess is that a similar kind of principle?
Yeah, I think it is. It all taps into this idea of that we really would like easy answers and we'd like them to be personalized, but we want them to come from someone else.
Right.
And that's kind of impossible to do when it comes to nutrition and vitamins. So the RDAs are the recommended dietary allowances, and they're what is used to calculate the numbers on your cereal box or your supplement label that say you're getting, you know, 100% of your RDA of C or whatever it is. Mm. And we do like to think about those, not just as personalized, like, yes, I myself have to get that amount per day. You know, but they're one size fits all, and then we need to get them every single day to be healthy. And then we need to hit that 100%, kind of like when you're studying for a test in high school. But in reality, the RDAs were, first of all, they were only created in 1943 partially as a response to concerns during World War II that the population wasn't going to be well nourished enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been updated every couple of years since then, because as the very first committee readily acknowledged, they didn't have enough information to make concrete recommendations for the whole population. And today, there's still works in progress. And what I think is important for us as consumers to recognize is that when you have to set recommendations for the whole country, you need to be very conservative with your recommendations. And you need to try your best to cover as many people as possible in the population with the recommendations, which means the technical definition of the RDA is the amount of a nutrient that's thought to meet the needs of 97 to 98% of the population in a particular group. Now, if you think about that, the analogy I like to use there is clothes, that, you know, if you're the government and you're trying to knit a sweater that's going to fit 97 or 98% of the American population, you'll have a sweater that's much larger than a lot of people need. Mm. You know, a lot of people would be just fine with a much smaller sweater. But in order to be sure that everyone's warm in winter, you need to make this really big sweater. And it's the same thing with the RDAs. And you also don't need to get it every day. It's the average over time. But the other thing I like to point out is that the RDAs on the back of the supplement and the food, the nutrition facts panels, are actually based on the recommendations from 1968.
Right.
They're very out of date. So if you are thinking that you are scoring an A+ on that daily test of your, you know, breakfast, you're not in terms of the latest recommendations.
Does it matter if you get the vitamin or the, you know, phytochemical or the mineral from an apple, you know, an orange or a kale leaf, or from a concentrated powder pressed into a pill? Like, what do we know about the difference? Is it better to get it from the actual fruit or vegetable?
I think the bottom line is that from what we know so far, it's always better to get the, if you're talking about like whole food powders and stuff, then they compress the substance of an apple into a pill. It's probably better to get it from the apple itself, because there's just stuff we don't know about that's in that apple. And also degradation and deterioration that happens when you try to put something to a pill. So it's better to do it that way. I mean, in terms of vitamins, like some vitamins are better absorbed from food than they are in supplements, and some are better absorbed in synthetic supplement form than in food. So that question is not one I really stress out too much about.
Yeah. Although you do mention broccoli in the book, for example,
I do mention broccoli.
Yeah, like when you tease out the, you know, the good stuff in broccoli and give it to people, that for some reason it doesn't quite work as well as giving them the actual piece of broccoli?
Yeah, and that's the question of synergy, which is another reason that nutritionists recommend getting your nutrients from foods that naturally contain them. And the idea of synergy is that substances work differently in isolation than they do when they're together with their other, in their natural context. And the analogy I like to use there is just all of us humans, that we probably act very differently when we're alone at home than we do if we're at work or in a crowd, even though we're the same people because of the context. So the broccoli study you're mentioning was just an example of how this could be coming into play. It was a study in which researchers gave subjects a particular compound in broccoli that's thought to have properties, protect you from cancer. And they found that it was much less effective when they gave this compound in isolation than it was when they gave the subjects, I believe it was freeze-dried broccoli florets, but broccoli florets basically that had other stuff in them. And their hypothesis, don't know if they know for sure, but their hypothesis was that the whole broccoli contained some sort of enzyme that was helping with the absorption of the anti-cancer compounds in the broccoli, that they were working together in some way that made the floret more effective than just taking out that one compound.
I mentioned we'd get to the idea of regulation and supplements, but let's take a break first and then get to that. Catherine Price is with us. Her book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Catherine Price. We're talking about her book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. So, yeah, one of the most controversial parts of this idea, this subject, is supplements and synthetic vitamins. You do point out early on, the book is not an attack on supplements and synthetics. And in fact, you make the point that man-made vitamins continue to prevent deficiencies all over the world. So it's really good. But it seems like they're essentially good. But then there are those that maybe make claims that go a little bit too far. So if you go to a GNC store, which you did, and you're walking down the aisles, give us a sense of what people see. What are the range of supplements and ideas that you find on those shelves?
Well, I think this is where the point we were talking about earlier in the show really comes into play, that as soon as you walk into a GNC, it becomes readily apparent that the word vitamin no longer refers to most people to just the 13 dietary chemicals that actually are the human vitamins. It's now a catch-all word that refers to a much, much larger category of products. The latest estimates I've seen are up to 85,000, although no one really knows for sure because you don't have to register your products with the FDA.
Right.
But if you walk into a GNC or even your, you know, local drugstore, you're going to see everything from traditional actual vitamins to substances like fish oil that have some pretty good science behind them. Obviously, minerals. Poor minerals. I leave them out just because the book's about vitamins. Don't want to leave. They're essential to life, too.
Yeah.
But then you also start to get to this, you know, the herbal and the botanicals. So you've got ginkgo biloba, St. John's wort, things like that. Then you can also have amino acids. You could have organs or glandulars, which are basically ground up organs or glands. Haven't done much research into that area myself because I didn't find it that appealing, but right. They do exist. And then you can also have other substances that are intended to be ingested by mouth to supplement your diet. So you can have bodybuilding powders, or you could have sexual enhancement products or weight loss things. It's really a huge, huge, huge range of products that would fall under this umbrella of dietary supplements, in which we often refer to as vitamins.
Vitamins created what you call this conceptual bridge between food and pharmaceuticals. And that's been I gather you think that's been kind of a problem in terms of the way we regulate, the way we talk about all this stuff.
Yeah, I just think it's a really interesting evolution, because if you think about it, you know, how should you regulate vitamin C? Like, right, it's in an orange. Are you going to say that oranges should be regulated like a drug? Because vitamin C also has drug-like properties against scurvy. So it kind of straddles these two categories. And I think that has been used by people who want to loosen the overall dietary supplement regulation as a way to say, like, wait a second, are you going to regulate oranges? That's just outlandish and absurd, you know, but that they're making that argument not to actually just refer to vitamins, but to refer to this much larger category. Yeah. And to my mind, when you start thinking about that, then you get to these products that are not found in oranges, you know, or maybe there's a compound in an orange that you find in tiny, tiny, tiny amounts that that do one thing when they're in the orange, but you're concentrating them into a supplement at a much higher dose. And the example that comes to mind is something called bitter orange extract that's used as a flavoring in marmalade and hasn't caused any problems as far as I know in marmalade. But if you put it into a very, very concentrated form, it can actually act as a stimulant, potentially dangerously. So there's a question of, you know, should that bitter orange be regulated the same when it's in marmalade as it is when you're putting it into a concentrated pill?
Well, the point is there's not much regulation of supplements. I mean, and I wanted to back up to the 1980s, because you write about this story that plays out, I think it was in 1980, in fact, that kind of revealed the consequences of lax regulation. It was this illness that emerged called EMS. Will you talk about that story?
Sure. I mean, it was this bizarre illness that basically really destroyed some people's lives. It was really horrible, and it turned out to be traced back to a supplement called L-tryptophan that a lot of people were taking for insomnia, among other things. And the exact cause of the disease actually was never perfectly isolated, but the best theory I've heard is it was from a contaminant in the supplements. But anyway, it was kind of an example of what can happen if you don't have a way to have safeguards in place to make sure that there aren't contaminants in these products, and also that the ingredients themselves are not going to cause harm. And, you know, there's many different things to say in regards to that story, but one thing I thought was very interesting is that during the congressional testimony about this, there was a scientist who'd done a lot of studies on L-tryptophan, and he was expressing how in some ways sad he was, because he was saying, well, first of all, L-tryptophan, which is a amino acid that you hear about in terms of turkey a lot, like people eat when they say a food coma after Thanksgiving, that's normally what they're talking about. But he was saying it does something, like there's no question that it does something. It's also not the same. It does not act the same when you take it out of the food and put it in an isolated form into a pill, kind of like the synergy thing we were talking about before. And he was just kind of sad because he said his belief was that this was a compound that really could have had benefits without many side effects to a large number of people, and that his hope had been that it would eventually be developed into some sort of pharmaceutical drug, whether it was over-the-counter or prescription, whatever. But instead, it had fallen into this category of dietary supplements, and there had been these tragedies and all this publicity around it. And now there was just no way that that ever was going to happen. It kind of had this, its reputation had been ruined.
The whole, this is kind of where Orrin Hatch comes into the story right around here, because there was this real battle in those days between the supplement industry and the federal government. It's probably ongoing to some degree, but it was really intense in those days. And you write a little bit about Orrin Hatch's story. He sold vitamins as a young man, it turns out, which is kind of interesting. But you say because of Orrin Hatch's influence, Congress really punted on the issue of supplement health claims. What role did he play in this story?
Well, you know, like any politician who's devoted to his base, he really has defended Utah's very, very large supplement industry. So, you know, a number of things, proposed bills that would protect the supplement industry in some way, probably the most, you know, making donations on behalf, I'm sorry, receiving donations on behalf of supplement companies. But I think that the most important thing to talk about was a law that was passed in 1994, both with his help and also in large part because of industry lobbying, called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. Right. And that act is basically what established the situation today, which is where dietary supplements are not required to be tested for safety or for efficacy before they're sold. And that has really opened the dietary supplement market enormously. If you consider that in 1994, there were an estimated 4,000 products on the market. And as I said a couple minutes ago, the estimate is now something like 85,000.
Wow. Wow.
And in Utah, I was just reading a statistic this morning that the dietary supplement industry was less than $1 billion in 1993 or early 90s, and now it's over $7 billion and is the state's number one industry. So just to give you a sense of how a piece of legislation really can have a very, very big impact on business, in this case, the supplements.
The supplement industry, they're pretty aggressive, they're pretty vocal, and you've heard the contentions that they're making. They say, for example, that regulations, if you over-regulate the industry, it will make people less healthy. They make that point. Another one you hear about, though, is that getting approval for supplements is so onerous. I mean, and they describe it the same way pharmaceuticals have to go through this process, which you yourself write about. You know, it takes like 12 years on average. It takes billions with a B dollars to get this passed. But is there a false equivalency there? How do you respond to that?
Well, yeah, I think there is definitely a false equivalency, because if you were to say that you're going to start regulating someone's thiamine, as you would say insulin, I have type 1 diabetes, so I'm take a lot of pharmaceutical drugs. You know, that's kind of ridiculous, because I don't think many people are going to be that worried about thiamine, which doesn't even have an upper limit in terms of the warnings about how much to take, because it's not immediately toxic. It's one of those. It is found in food. So I think what often happens is that the supplement industry obviously they would prefer to have looser regulations. I actually don't necessarily think that it's good business practice, but many of the players in the industry would rather have it be loose. And so one way to defend themselves against that is to assert that the only alternative would be to have dietary supplements or even vitamins. They always focus on vitamins because they seem so innocent, regulated like pharmaceutical drugs. But that fails to recognize that there's an enormous category of products that do have more stringent controls, but that are not pharmaceutical drugs, not just over-the-counter drugs, but even things like deodorant or dandruff shampoo are the two examples I think of, or toothpaste. And if you look on the back of those boxes, you'll see that they actually have drug facts on them, which I thought was really surprising. And then I actually looked up, this is what I've been doing in my free time, I looked up some of the standards for what the guidance on what you should do to try to get a antiperspirant, you know, approved for sale. And it's all these things about the percentage of sweat reduction in your right armpit versus your left armpit and all this stuff. And they're not asking companies in that case to go out and necessarily do proactive studies, let alone for billions of dollars in 12 years. But they want to have substantiation before it goes on the market that it's going to work and it's not going to like peel someone's armpit off. And so, you know, who knows what the correct answer is to how the supplement market should be regulated, but it's not a binary thing between pharmaceutical drugs and the current state of supplements. You could have something where, for example, companies had to proactively give the FDA some evidence of safety and efficacy before they sold the product, versus now they don't have to do that. And it's only after the product's on the market that the FDA can come after them if the FDA thinks that there's a problem, but the onus is on the FDA to find the problem.
Right. I want to shift into the, sort of where we're headed in nutritional science, because this is the last part of your book. And this is the part of the book where you, as you described, find yourself standing in this field in California, nibbling on an alfalfa leaf. explain that part of the story, what you, because you're looking into the future of nutritional science.
Yes, it wasn't just because I like nibbling on alfalfa leaves. Although they're very interesting. They had this like almost meaty feeling to them, I think because there's a lot of protein in them, but it didn't feel like nibbling on clover, which I've also done. So. But yeah, so I had gone out to California to this this company called Nutrilite that makes plant-based supplements. And I basically was trying to get a firsthand sense of some of the mysteries of plants. Mm-hmm. So the book starts with me in a vitamin manufacturing company called DSM that's one of the world's largest, actually it is the world's largest producer of synthetic vitamins. And I convinced them to let me taste some of the raw ingredients, the actual vitamins, which I just found fascinating. Like B12, it's hot pink, who knew? Yeah. And thiamine's very bitter. But anyway, at the end of the book, I went out to Nutrilite and I wanted to get a sense of what else was in plants. So they specialize in these plant-based powders that are supposed to be isolate, like basically taking the water and the fiber out of fruits and vegetables and isolating everything else into a pill that you then can take to supplement your diet. And I was just curious to explore that aspect of things and kind of get a tangible sense via my sense of taste of what some of the mysteries of plants were. So I convinced my tour guide, who I really hope didn't get in trouble for this, but I convinced him to let me try some of these plant powders. So I was, you know, dipping my fingers into these little like concentrations of tomato or marigold or apple. Apple was disgusting.
Yeah.
I was totally surprised by the apple. It tasted like ash. It was just bitter and astringent. And it was just interesting to me because I was having that taste linger on my tongue and I was thinking, is this really what's inside an apple? Like, how can this correlate to the taste of an apple, you know, that we've had in our school lunchboxes or something? It doesn't make sense. And how could this be helping my health? What is it in there?
So where are we in our understanding of these interactions between, you spend some time with phytochemicals, for example, in that last part of the book, and then, but also vitamins and nutrients and how they work in the body. I mean, one of the nutritional scientists you talked to said we're really just kind of at the tip of the iceberg in understanding all these interactions and how they work.
Yeah, we are. It's an incredibly difficult subject to get to the bottom of. So if you think about it, nutrition is something that affects us every day of our lives over long periods of time. You can't, or it's very difficult to do randomized controlled experiments, which is the golden standard for scientific research, where you have a control group who doesn't have any of the substance you're studying, and then a group that does when the substance in question is, say, found in tomatoes, and you're trying to do it over 30 years. Like, that's going to, first of all, cost a lot, and it's kind of hard to make sure that your subjects are doing what you think they're doing. And then you have this question of interactions. I mean, it's one thing to say that vitamin C in isolation will cure scurvy. That's a pretty direct cause and effect relationship that you can demonstrate in a lab. And it's another thing to try to figure out what any of these particular chemicals are doing over long periods of time, especially in the presence of other chemicals. There's just an infinite combinations that you can have. And that's why, you know, one of my conclusions at the end of the book was, first of all, how much uncertainty there is. And then second, how to deal with that uncertainty. Because at first, as a journalist trying to write a book about vitamins, I was pretty freaked out by the fact that I couldn't get any answers to these questions. I was thinking, oh my goodness, I've got a book due. What am I going to say? And then I realized that that's kind of the point, is that we don't know the answers. And the question becomes, why are we so obsessed with trying to pin them down instead of saying that, you know, just as in life, there are things we can't understand, there's things in nutrition we can't understand. But what we do know is that it seems to be the most beneficial to get nutrients in their natural context and at levels naturally found in food. So in as much as we can, why not try to get them that way?
Yeah. Embrace the uncertainty, I think, is how you
put it. Yeah, it could be a bumper sticker.
Yeah, exactly. Let me finally, since we're running out of time, I mean, the book is more about exploring the science about all of this than particular recommendations. But you do point out that the more we understand about this stuff, the easier it is to decide, you know, what to eat. So I wanted to go through some of the points that you make, just kind of quickly. You and this all sounds so obvious, I guess, but choose foods that are high in vitamins that nature put there, not that humans put there. Before you buy fortified products, you say you should ask yourself why it's been fortified, and you know, would I buy it if it hadn't been? Try improving your diet, you say, before you turn to a pill like a multivitamin. And then here's one also. You say that don't let the fact that something is fortified give it a nutritional free pass, which means so your Twinkie may have, what, thiamine or whatever in it, but
Right.
Doesn't mean it's so good for you, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just try to take a step back and, yeah, like you said, ask if you would eat this food or buy this food if it didn't have those added vitamins, and if it would be healthy without those added vitamins. And if the answer is no, then eat it if you really love the taste, but don't think you're getting a nutritional boost. But yeah, if you're going just for health, then pick something else.
Well, I think it all comes around to something that a point you kind of make from time to time in the book, and that is that simplicity is probably the key. I mean, you mentioned, I wish we had time to talk about this protective diet. There's this vitamin researcher that you referred to actually earlier, Elmer McCollum, who came up with this diet. It was 100 years ago, but that seems to have made the most sense to you, and it was really, really simple. We've got about a minute left. You want to say something about that finally?
All right, let's see if I can do it. Yeah, the protective diet, I mean, in the 20s, basically it's the idea of eat foods that have some protective effect on your health. And Elmer McCollum defined that as a diet high in leafy greens and fruits and some degree of dairy products and, you know, meats and things. He did it because it was really hard. You could not measure vitamins or nutrients at that point. But I'm arguing that today we should adopt a protective diet because it is based on the idea of what we do know and acknowledges how much we don't, that we don't need to know all the details of how food works in our bodies. We can just center our diets, as I was saying before, around foods that naturally contain vitamins, with the logic being that if they contain vitamins, they likely contain other things too at the doses that our bodies have evolved to use the best. So don't stress about making your food into a math problem. Just focus on foods that naturally contain vitamins, and I think you'll be further towards good health.
It's Catherine Price. Her book is called Vitamania, or Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. She joined us from the campus of Temple University in Philadelphia. Catherine Price, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Braden Child. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.